Good evening. James McCanna here with my Science Hour, November 1st, 2012. And as you know, we are changing frequencies this week. We are now airing on 5070, the 9.350 frequency going away for the winter during this hour. So at any rate, as the nighttime hour changes, the dusk hour changes, we switch frequencies. This is an FCC requirement, not of the station, but at any rate, that's just for better communication so you can hear me better. Okay, so we're on November 1st, 2012. Main science topic, I've got about five of them tonight. One, of course, will be the what I believe was manipulated storm Sandy. And oh my goodness, are the weather, climate change people out in mass, out in full force, trying to tell you that, oh, this is what they expected, weather change. And this is the interplay between tier two garbage science and the tier one level that controls these storms. There's no doubt in my mind that Sandy was a manipulated storm for maximum destruction. What I have called, I've been a guest on a number of shows this week, I call it geopolitical social engineering. And so that's a term I want you to remember as a term I started using relative to the massive damage from Hurricane Sandy. And first they drove it over Cuba. That ought to give you a clue right there. They really love to drive hurricanes over Cuba. Remember, was it 2 years ago? They had five in a row go over Cuba, the last one running completely full length over Cuba. Tremendous amount of damage with those storms. But Hurricane Sandy, not reported much in the U.S., went first over Cuba. Then it swung west over to Florida, only to run up the eastern seaboard. It drove the shore damage in Florida was tremendous. And then, of course, the rain damage. In a hurricane like this, the majority of damage is due to rain. Of course, wind is a big factor with Sandy, too. It did a lot of damage with the wind. But water is a tremendously damaging factor in any storm. And Sandy took its toll big time in the Northeast. Now the mayors and the government are talking about building islands offshore of New York, putting a bigger storm wall around. But remember that a storm wall also holds water in. Now you have to put pumps like New Orleans to pump the water out because you have storm walls, because the water cannot escape. If you put a big wall around New York, and of course the storm walls around New York were only about 5 feet high, not expecting a massive hurricane, and the storm surge was about 11 feet, so it just came pouring over into the East Coast. And then the storm itself, however, was felt as far away as the interstates, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, getting a tremendous amount of effect from this storm. But clearly, I did not have time this week. I was just busy to the wall with some projects, so I did not post on my webpage. I just many times leave my information for the show and let the show do the talking for me. Okay, so I'll be talking more about Sandy and what I call weather bombing, another term I developed a number of years ago. Okay, so I'll just go through these topics in order. First of all, a little bit of announcement. Last spring, I was in Los Angeles. I did many, many things, actually, when I was out on the West Coast. But one of them was I did a series of film sessions with the History Channel. And this is going to air coming up here starting November 9th, I believe it is. But check your local listings because the History Channel, depending on what cable or dish or network you listen to or see, it carries at a different time and possibly even different day. But starting around November 6th to 9th, somewhere on the station or channel that you listen to. I will be on a six-part series. It's called 2012 Countdown to Armageddon. And there's I'll be appearing a little bit on some of them, and then quite a bit more on others. So with that as a pre-announcement, just watch for that. I'm not at liberty to talk about the content of the filming because they have other people. I've an agreement with the History Channel to not talk about content. So at any rate, I will not talk about any content issues. And of course, like anything, I did many, many hours of filming, and what gets finally edited into the final product is, of course, very limited. You're used to listening to me on a 1 hour show here and sometimes 2-3 hour interview on other shows, or at least an hour. So, you know, you get a little bit of a flavor for what I'm saying. And then, of course, it's edited in with the objective of the History Channel. So, at any rate, without being specific, just watch for that. And that's coming up starting around November 6th to 9th on your local station, the History Channel. It's called 2012 Countdown to Armageddon. And like I say, I believe I'm in all six parts. And so, watch for that. Last week, I missed a number of topics, so I'm going to quick catch up on those. Italian astronomers, or not astronomers, these were meteorologists, scientists, or I'm sorry, let's go back a step. They were geologists who were on an Italian board, a governmental board, to predict earthquakes and give information to the public to prevent or give preemptive information to the public about earthquakes, because Italy has volcanoes, they have earthquakes, etc. So the point is that these scientists were convicted, given 6-year sentences, and the way the scientists interpreted this event in the United States is, oh my goodness, they were convicting these scientists for being wrong, and so no scientist should put his head on the chopping block for being wrong. But that's not what they were convicted of. They were convicted, basically, of bad communication, something that is rampant. And now we have, for example, after the fact, we have Hurricane Sandy, and now climatologists are saying, this is a sign of global warming. Well, there's no hard data associating global warming with anything. It's like stick a thermometer out the window, measure the temperature. Oh, the temperature rose, therefore we're going to have bigger hurricanes. There's absolutely no scientific reality to any of this. It's just a bunch of scientists sitting in their office. And I've said many times the temperature change is not the same as heat change. There are many factors. So at any rate, scientists are sitting on their laurels doing very poor scientific work, using totally incorrect scientific terms. And now that we have Hurricane Sandy, a manipulated storm by the Tier 1 scientists, then you have the Tier 2 scientists jumping up and down saying, look, that's what we were talking about. But see, that's the dog and pony show that they want you to see. Because, now people think, we got to do all of this government stuff. The government's got to come in and save us from global warming. And it's a government control issue. A number of years ago, as we crossed into the year 2000, it was used to control water. Governments all over the world gained control of water because of global warming. So at any rate, but now these scientists in Italy are convicted, 6-year sentences. The real issue is bad communication. When they gave the preemptive information for that area, it had like a relatively heavy earthquake, and something like 300 people died. The scientists were blamed But if you look at what they were convicted of poor information. They took government money. They joined panels claiming to be experts. And then after the earthquake, after they gave confused and conflicting results to the public, saying they really didn't think there would be an earthquake there, or certainly not a major one, then they said, well, we don't have any predictive value at all. We couldn't predict hurricanes. What are you talking about? What are you convicting us for? Well, why did they take government-paying jobs to be on a panel to give preemptive information to the public about earthquakes when they had zero capability of predicting? You see what I'm saying? These guys are idiots. I don't think they should be convicted for poor science. They should be convicted for being basically scammers. They're taking money, pretending to be something, and then when the event happens, they say, well, we don't have any predictive value at all. I want to review an event that happened in the United States about a year ago. It was William Gray and his sidekick from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, the Hurricane Prediction Center, the National Hurricane Prediction Center. And they had a laundry list, about 35 factors that they had in a computer model, trying to predict the strength and paths of hurricanes. And I said all along, I said, this guy and his crew are full of it. And that's the best thing I could say about him. So finally, about a year ago, they stood up and resigned. And with their resignation was a short statement saying that they had no predictive value, that nothing they did over the past 20 years had any value at all, and they weren't going to do it anymore. They weren't going to put out this annual hurricane prediction. And then every time there was a plethora of storms, they would downgrade their prediction, or if there were more storms, they would upgrade their prediction, so at the end of the year, they came out right. What a joke. What an absolute joke. So these guys finally stood up, and it wasn't them talking, and I'm still trying to find out, did some attorney talk to them? Did they go and talk to, or were they afraid of this kind of vengeance if there was a major hurricane and a lot of people died and they predicted it would go one way, and that actually happened. There was a hurricane, one of the four that hit a number of years ago in Florida. It came up the west coast of Florida, and they said, no, it's going north, and it came into the Tampa Bay area, and the people were totally unprepared. There could have been a lawsuit, a series of damaging repercussions for these alleged scientists at that time, but nothing happened. They're protected more in the United States, apparently, for bad science, bad predictions, and nobody said much. I pointed out in one of my books, I forget which one, that during Hurricane Floyd, they predicted that it would swing north and miss Florida. So nobody in Florida reacted. And why did they not react in Florida? Because they wanted to keep the tourism open. Kids were in school. Dade County did not evacuate. In fact, Dade County didn't even have an evacuation plan in place, which is so absurd it's beyond belief. But southern Florida, Miami, Dade County, without even an evacuation plan. But due to the hurricane, the National Hurricane Prediction Center prediction that it would miss Florida, nobody moved. The kids were still in school, and this hurricane marching towards Florida. If they were wrong, probably millions of people would have died. And by the way, the death count in Sandy, how absurd. They say, oh, 50 people died. Yeah, with all the homeless people, the street people, the people in very poor low-level housing in New York City. Basically, they flushed out New York City just like they flushed out New Orleans. And this is the untold story. These people have no voice. The news media does not cover their story, and it never will. And they give some absurdly low death count, and those are people that simply did not have the means to escape, to leave. And so countless thousands, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people dead in New York. And nobody is going to say a word about them. But at any rate, back to these Italian scientists convicted. All I can say is they took the money. They took the money and pretended to be something they were not. And so if I were going to convict them, I'd convict them of being scammers and delusionary scientists and basically running a scam. And that's what a lot of science is today. Tier 2 science is a giant scam. They're collecting the money. And so all over the world now, scientists are hunkering down trying to figure out how they can still be their Tier 2 science, still put it out there, but not be responsible for it. What a good deal. Get the paycheck, but no responsibility. I love it. Government science at its best. Okay, so enough of the Italian scientists that were convicted. That'll give them 6 years to think about what they did. But the real conviction was because of bad communication. Tier 2 level scientists are notorious for bad communication. That's why you don't hear them on radio shows. These guys, you know, can hardly talk, say their own name a lot of times. And all they can talk about is their esoteric little corner of the world, and they can't communicate with the public. And by the way, that's why a lot of people listen to this show, because I can see through the lines. I know what the gig is out there with science. And, you know, when they say something, you know, you have to read through the lines, see what the history is, and then interpret it. And I know a lot of people now are able to do that for themselves thanks to this show. Okay, so at any rate, let me see other things on last week's show. Scotland has a project, a big, big mega project, and a prize at the end of it. I forget what it is. It's like $5 or $10 million or maybe $1 million. I don't remember. But at any rate, at the end of a five-year program, they want to develop sea wave power to power the electricity. They are like many islands. They don't have the resources they have to import for energy, and it costs more than they produce. So they're basically under the gun to produce some kind of free energy, something that they can set up and it'll run forever. And they think that some scientists, again, bad Tier 2 science over there, well at work, you see all the little political puppets lined up in a row, signing their little document and hoping that in 5 years they will have energy flowing off the North Sea because of wave energy. And they do. They have a lot of wave energy, but to capture wave energy, it's not going to solve their problem. Why? Because the wave energy is spread all over the place. If you put a line of bobbers or whatever they use, like big floats, and they float up or they change shape or whatever they do, and they deliver, you can convert that into energy, electrical energy, and then pipe it back to land. And that's what they're trying to do. But the wave energy is all over the ocean. So it's kind of like sunlight. Sunlight is if you take the average amount of sunlight on the state of Arizona, if you could cover the state of Arizona and New Mexico with solar panels, you would be able to power the United States. But let's look at the cost of doing that. The cost and just the raw materials and converting the raw materials into solar panels and putting them out there and implementing them would be horrendous, the absolute cost, or the cost of putting up one wind tower. People don't realize what's the payback. If you took all of the energy to make a wind tower and all of the components and the absolute devastating economical results, like in China where they mine the rare elements to put in the magnets in generators, if you look at all of the expense of putting up a wind tower, it's enormous. How long is it going to take that wind tower running at about a 10% efficiency, and then downtime not included? How long is it going to take? The average industry, by the way, they say is 21%. I don't believe that for a second. I'd say it's more like 10% or 8% on wind generation. But how long is it going to take for the payback on that? So anyway, back to the North Sea and Scotland and their little wave project, how long is this going to succeed is the basic question. And no, it's not. It's they're dealing with Tier 2 science. And you see, I've said this before, the only projects that get funded in energy, and they put a lot of money into them, including Westinghouse and other companies around the world, a lot of money is pushed into these projects that simply will not succeed to give the illusion that something is being done, that something is being done with alternative energy. But 5 years will go by and nothing will happen, and Scotland will be back in the same situation it is in now. Because you simply, the expense of covering the North Sea with wave generators, wave electrical generators, is too enormous. So I see them pulling out big tanks, and it looks like, wow, these are mega projects. But the end result, just like wind in the United States, you see fields of, in Kansas, in Nebraska, fields and fields of wind generators, and the end result, they're not doing anything. 99% of them are sitting there not moving. It's a joke. Okay, anyway, enough of that. Let me see if I have other... just a quick notice on Comet C2012-S1, and I will be talking more about that in a second, that there's an indication that it could have been... it could be a comet, I believe it was 1860. There was a great comet that passed through the solar system, and immense comet. In fact, people committed suicide over it, thinking that it was going to devastate Earth. But at any rate, they believe, some people believe, that this comet could be the great comet of 1862. I'm trying to think. But I'll get some more information on that for next week. But this could be a comet that was already here, which is kind of strange because that's not what NASA is saying. They were saying that this is on a hyperbolic orbit, an orbit that would indicate that it has never been here before. So once again, NASA hiding the data, faking the data, giving bad results. By the way, I believe I mentioned, but I will do it again, that now I know that this comet will be coming about 26 astronomical units. No, not 26 astronomical units. Retract that. 26 lunar distances from Mars. Okay, so this is about 7 million miles. A big comet like this one can have a coma up to 20 million miles wide, which means that little Mars could disappear into the coma of this comet. And remember that the news media, now I've seen some news media blips on this comet, and they're all very sure to tell you that this is a little icy wanderer, and don't bother looking at it until the end of November next year when it starts to come close to the sun. They do not, I repeat, they do not want you looking at this comet when it comes by Mars. And we have a perfect viewing session. It'll start around early to mid-September of next year. So mark your calendars. And I want everybody up and watching this comet. And, of course, comets can fizzle out. There's no way to predict. But from what we're seeing here, this could be a real light show in the sky. Mars will be a red dot in the eastern horizon starting around about 4 or 5 in the morning. And the comet will be bearing down from the backside of Mars. Mars will be swinging around in its orbit, and they're going to come extremely close. The comet will be, in as far as your vantage point, the comet will be above Mars. So you'll be looking at the eastern horizon. Mars will come up about 3 o'clock in the morning, or 3 to 4 in the morning. Will actually rise, but the comet will rise first. It will be above Mars from your vantage point. And by the way, what I've done is I have drawn, and I'll be posting these as soon as I can get to it, on my webpage, but drawings of what you are going to see in the morning sky, where to look, what time, and then also all of the other electrical alignments with Venus, with Mercury, and where the comet will be, and relative to the planets, what to look for, the potential electrical discharges between this comet and the planets. Jupiter is also included in some of these, so it's good. I hope it's a real light show. That's all I can tell you. But NASA is trying as hard as it can to post in the news media that don't look at this thing until the end of November. There's nothing to see. Don't look at Mars. They're not even mentioning Mars. In fact, there's data that should be posted on the official NASA webpage talking about the close encounters, and it's just very subtly missing. So NASA very clearly given the order to quiet, just don't talk at all about the these issues with Comet C2012-S1. Okay, I'm going to read from the book that I read from last week. Now, this is called Watchers of the Sky by Willie Ley. That's W-I-L-L-Y, and then Ley is L-E-Y. It's a tremendous history, printed in 1963. And it was something, it's a book I've had my whole life. And so, or not my whole life, because I was born before then, but this week I'm going to read about, once again, from the Planet 18 on the chapter on Planet X, Chapter 18. And so anyway, I'm going to go on to page 419 and read a little bit from Chapter 18 on Planet X. And this is very interesting because you see this from a perspective written in 1963, but of occurrences that occurred in the 1800s. Okay, this is from page 419. Okay, by sheer coincidence, well, let me just catch up on this. They're talking about Neptune, Uranus, and the fact that those planets' orbits are not what they should be. When they discovered Neptune, they said, well, this doesn't account for all perturbations in the orbit of Uranus, so there must be another planet out there. So they went through about 20 years of trying to make estimates of where this other planet was. And so here we go. We're starting with another episode of information that implies that there's another planet somewhere out there beyond, a tenth planet, so to speak. It says, by sheer coincidence, during the same year, 1879, in which Peters demolished Ferguson's unknown planet, and that refers to one astronomer negating one other astronomer, Ferguson's, estimate of where the planet would be, they finally decided that that could not be. That was another attempt to coordinate that information. But at any rate, what they're starting here is, what they're saying here is that in that year, one astronomer disproved that there was a reasonable estimate by another astronomer, but as soon as he did that, other information came out of the woodworks. So reading again. By sheer coincidence, during the same year, 1879, in which Peters demolished Ferguson's unknown planet, another astronomer added another hint as to the existence of a planet beyond Neptune. This was Camille Flammarion, who 10 years earlier had founded the Society of Astronomy in France. And by the way, I just happen to have here Flammarion's Book of Astronomy, something I'll be reading out of in the future. And it's very interesting to see these ancient books, that's a big book. It's called the Flammarion Book of Astronomy, and that's where it came from, Camille Flammarion from the 1800s. But I'll be reading from that because it's very, very interesting to see the point of view from these ancient, or not ancient, but, a couple hundred year ago astronomers. Okay, reading on. As has been explained in Chapter 7, the comets seem to be permanent members of the solar system, though at the enormous distance of half a light year or more. Once in a while, one of them, for still unknown reasons, approaches the sun. And by the way, the Tier 2 science has come up with a ridiculous, non-unprovable concept of the Oort cloud. And you can see that that did not exist when this book was printed in 1963. Just to give you the timing of that. Okay, so anyway, then the comet becomes a member of the inner solar inner circle, which occurs when it passes a major planet that changes the very long comet orbit into a shorter orbit with the major axis of the order of magnitude of planetary distances from the sun. In other words, a planet captures a comet. And so this is what I have been talking about. My whole premise of the plasma discharge comet model, of course, is based on a electrical capacitor around the sun when comets come in, but also that capture is the primary method of building the solar system, that these members are captured by the other planets. We might see some of this activity going on next fall when C-2012 passes Mars. But at any rate, they are very open about talking about capture of comets here. They also do not limit comets to being small items, like little teeny puffballs. There's no mention of that. Okay. Anyway, reading on, as has also been explained, the aphelion of the new orbit then falls in the vicinity of the orbit of the planet which brought it about the so-called capture. Usually, but not in all cases, the new aphelion of the comet is somewhat farther from the sun than is the aphelion of the capturing planet. In other words, let me translate that. When a planet, say Neptune or Uranus or Jupiter, captures a comet, the comet typically has an orbit that falls far to the inside of that planet, but the outside point of the elliptical orbit of the comet, the new orbit of the comet, lies outside the orbit of the capturing planet. And that guarantees that there's going to be more interactions, but the end result is that this comet is going to continue to work itself into the solar system, bit by bit becoming a new moon or planet. And this is the way solar systems work. And of course, NASA denies this. They don't want anything to do with this. And Tier 2 science, the flat Earth science of modern science, just classifies these comets as something different. There's something over there, little teeny, they go away, don't worry about them. That's modern Tier 2 science. But the reality is they can be big. Not all comets are big, some of them, a few of them are big, and when they're captured, they can become new planets and members of the solar system. And NASA cannot try hard enough to deny this. And of course, all of the data points towards this. And once they get out with spacecraft nose to nose to a comet, what do they find? A black, tarry, hot object. And they still call it a dirty snowball. You know, it can't get any more ludicrous than that. Reading on from Willie Lay's Watchers of the Skies. Okay, now it says, now we were talking about the capture of comets. It says, hence a planet beyond Neptune might betray its existence by one or more several comets with aphelia beyond Neptune. Camille Flammarion not only called attention to this possibility, but even suggested two comets that might be captives of the unknown planet, namely Comet 1862-3 with an orbital period of about 120 years and an aphelion of 47.6 astronomical units from the Sun, and Comet 1889-3 with a somewhat longer orbital period. Okay, the unknown planet, Flammarion stated, probably moved at a distance around 45 AU. Okay, so this dialogue goes back and forth. So you can see what people were doing back in the 1800s. But once again, let's fast forward up to the 1980s when a guy named Dr. Harrington with the Naval Observatory went on an all-out campaign to find this planet. They knew from modern observations that Uranus and Neptune, the orbits were being perturbed by something. It had to be big, and at that point they realized that it was pulling down. Every time Uranus and Neptune came around a certain part of their orbit, they got pulled down. So that told them exactly where in the solar system this object should be. Harrington set out on a 10-year quest to locate and determine where the planet was. And, of course, that was a big major in astronomy. That would be a major accomplishment and a major goal. Okay, so at any rate, in the early 1900s, they hit pay dirt. Harrington was photographing the planet. He was using an 8-inch astrograph, a small 8-inch telescope, camera telescope, in New Zealand, and he was on his way back to the United States with the latest round of data when he mysteriously died at a relatively young age. And people could say, oh, that's just conspiracy theory, whatever. Okay, well, let's just play devil's advocate and say that he died a natural death. Why did the work that he started and had conclusive results on an object called Planet X, why was it never continued? That is the question on the table. And of course, nobody in the psyops, nobody in the disinformation crews, none of them want to talk about that. And that's why it's good that you listen to this show, because I point out these little nuances. So let's say that Harrington did die a natural cancer death. Well, why did they not continue his work? Why did it get buried? Why did the information that NASA had never surface to the public? Okay, enough said. Okay, I'll be continuing in future weeks to read from Watchers of the Sky and also the Flammarion Book of Astronomy from the origins of that book back in the 1800s. And by the way, when I was at Cornell, my tenure there during 1979 to 81, and by the way, I was not tenured, that's a term, but if I were tenured, I'd still be there. But clearly, that was not the case. But the point is, they had a book there called by TJJC and another guy named Newton. And by the way, they had written a book on the capture of objects into the solar system. And they had two major, major volumes on this capture process, and they basically said this is the way that solar systems are formed. But they had a little problem. In that time, they suggested that the orbital circularization and the capture, part of the slowing down of these objects after they were captured by another major planet, part of that process was a drag that had to be in the solar system as these objects swept through what they called the resisting medium. Well, it was clearly discovered that there was no such resisting medium, so therefore their theory was put aside as being not viable. The only thing is, when I came along in 1979, I already had my comet work developed, and I realized that the tail drag actually came with the comet. As the comet pulled in the tail material, it slowed down the comet nucleus, and that was the long-lost key, the never-discovered key, to understanding how solar systems form. The drag that was necessary for TJJC, for their model to work, was locked in the concept of the plasma discharge comet model, which I developed, and named at that point, also named the concepts of electric universe in one of my published papers, being widely copied now by some scammers and wannabes on the internet. But the point is that the full working of the solar system and how the solar system develops, I developed it during those years with the data that was also coming in from NASA space probes. But at any rate, I will be reading, another reason I'm reading from these older texts is to point out where things were, where theoretical developments were at in the history of science, leading up to where I came in with the key elements of how solar systems form, with the plasma discharge comet model, the capture of comets, the fact that comets can be large, and then equating that with historical records. So that was a lot of key work in there, putting together those major pieces of the puzzle. And notwithstanding that, there were other major discoveries that came out of that, one being the solar capacitor, that weather systems are driven by the solar electrical wind. They have zero to do with the heat energy coming from the sun. And the storm like Sandy now can be manipulated because the Tier 1 scientists realize that the energy that drives storms comes from the ionosphere. That's why it's so important for global warming and this ridiculous theory that hurricanes form from the heat from ocean water. Where was the heat in the North Atlantic that drove this storm into New York? Where was the warm water that drove that storm up into a frenzy? Well, it isn't. It was in the North Atlantic, which is frigid. This is we're in pushing November here, and the end of October, and this storm got to be major proportions, built up and built up and built up, coming up the eastern seaboard. And the hurricanes, that's not something that's really going to happen. And besides, we did not have the solar conditions to drive this storm. There's all of these indicators point to the fact that Sandy was a manipulated storm. It was sent in for geopolitical, social engineering of that area, just like they did with Katrina in New Orleans. Weather bombing is another term that I use. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to mention in both the Flammarion Book of Astronomy and in Watchers of the Sky, there are many passages where they talk about comets being big. They do not differentiate. They don't say that comets could be small as far as the nucleus is concerned. And so this idea that comets are little and fluffy and soft and teeny and tiny and cannot do any harm to Earth only if they crash into it, which is a very, very rare event, this is a modern construct of the world of astronomy and NASA. And it's clear flat Earth Tier 2 science pawned off on the public to keep you from thinking about comets. There's been a huge, huge effort to minimize the idea that comets could do anything, and of course that is to bash Velikovsky primarily. He was the great founder of that, and then persons like myself who come along and tell you that no, comets can be big. They constantly refer to Halley's Comet as being a small comet, and Earth interacted with it in 1910, and nobody died except for people that jumped out of the windows, etc. But the reality is that Halley's is a little teeny, it is a very small comet, a very below average small comet. So no, you wouldn't expect a lot to happen. But if we pass by Hale-Bopp or a medium or a larger size comet, then yeah, some sparks would fly, some gravitational interactions would occur, and life as you know it on Earth would change. Okay, so anyway, let's move on. Okay, just a couple quick product announcements here. There is some corn left. After all of the shipping and packaging of corn, there is some left, and I'm going to put that up. This is, remember, there won't be any corn sale next spring. This will be up on the web page shortly after the show, and I'm not sure if it's there right now, but if not, it'll be there shortly after this show. The price is going to go up, not astronomically, but it's going to be, before it was $50 for 10 pounds, which was an absolute steal, really, and a lot of people got in on that. The price is going to raise, basically doubling that to $100 for 10 pounds. And we've got some packaged into 20-pound boxes for $150. So at any rate, there was just a little bit left from this year's harvest. And that was, that's the only thing I can tell you is, and it's a very limited basis, only in the United States. We don't ship this foreign. And remember that if you're shopping for holiday, Christmas presents, whatever, just remember my webpage, the JMCCSCI webpage, JMCCSCI.com, short for J. McCanney, science.com, but use the short version, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and the corn will be posted there. Along with other products. Remember the calendar, the emergency survival recalendar sun star clock. And this has been really a good response to this. It would be a perfect Christmas gift for someone. And you can ship these to anybody else. You can put in your order, put in somebody else's address and have it shipped there. And have it as a Christmas present, but the calendar would make a great present. Books, the CDs, the DVDs, all of those would make great Christmas presents. And then there's the water filter items. Give something that people will use and use and use. They, every time they get clean filtered water out of their water filter, or if you know someone that already has a water filter, get them the pre-filter. I have the modular storage system, 6.5 gallon tanks in two of the new dome filters, high capacity dome filters, along with 3 6.5 gallon tanks to store water with seals, with rubber, the caps have screw-on rubber seal caps. That's on the webpage, the pre-filter, the name brand. Remember that I have name brand filters and water filter systems. It saves you over $100. I also have the Daltons there. People do buy those. They're very expensive. But I now have my name branded water filters and filter elements and accessories, which are a great deal, the same high quality. It's just that the name branding gives you a big savings. Okay. Enough of that said, but make sure if you want to get corn, by the way, if you have over a $400 order, you get the corn for free. If you have over a $300 order, you get the calendar for free. And so if you, right now, the way it is, if you have a $400 order or more, you get the calendar free and the corn for free, a 10-pound box of corn. This is the Dent corn, non-GMO, no chemicals. So at any rate, okay, enough of that. Okay, I'm still working on the, this is talking about the comet C2012-S1. I'm still working on the long list of alignments and interactions that this comet will have as it moves through the solar system. Remember that January 15th, we could have some interactions with this comet on planet Earth. We have a new moon passing. It's a prime condition for one of the first real jolts that the inner solar system might get from this comet. The comet itself will be out around the orbit of Jupiter, so nowhere near us. But I also want to point out, in every show I want to point this out as much as I can. Remember the comet Ellen and people, and oh, it's going to be the end of the world, and all the alignments, and they were trying to use my name. And I worked every week on the radio and I on my show, and I worked every week doing interviews, and I had a special subpage on my homepage saying that there was nothing to Comet Elenin, that it was a nothing comet, and nothing was what major would happen on Earth. The disinformation crew was out there trying to use my name, and then the astronomers would come in and point and look what Jim McCanney is doing, and I was saying the exact opposite. But you had little puppet pages out there like Sat.net, little scammers over there in France, trying to use my name to raise money for their, you know, their send them a donation which is absurd, and I tried to get my name off of there, but they cannot be contacted. Clearly a government disinformation page. Quiet as a church mouse in regard to Comet C2012-S1. Isn't that interesting? You can see who's who out there. When the real comets come in, let's put it this way, when the fake comets come in, the ones that aren't going to do anything, they're jumping up and down saying it's the end of the world, trying to use my name. And then, and a whole bunch of other websites too, all of the other little copycat wannabes out there. But when this real comet comes in, they're quiet as a church mouse. And so doesn't that tell you something? Who's pulling the strings on those sites? Who butters their bread? So at any rate, I will be posting, however, all of the interactions coming up for Comet C2012-S1. And just as a side note, just a reminder, I only post on my webpage. I do not post on any other person's webpage. Nobody has authorization to use my name or to use my material, and or to paraphrase my material. It's only on my webpage and on my radio show and through my books. And my webpage is the only legitimate source for my books, DVDs, and CDs. So if you look on Amazon or any of those other places, don't buy anything there. If they say they're new, they're not. I guarantee you nobody has new books of my books anywhere on the planet, except one person. Pastor Peter's Scriptures for America is one place where they do sell my books, so I got to tell you that. I believe they have the Planet X and the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet there. But they're the only people on the planet, because they are long-trusted associates. But other than that, you find on the Internet, Amazon, none of those books are legitimate. So at any rate, just a little side posting there. In the past, I've talked about the winds of Jupiter, where we, every year, we become aligned with the planet Jupiter electrically, and it causes a great deal of wind activity on planet Earth. And we are heading into that right now. I had a friend of mine, a talk show host, by the way, who is starting to air shows again, James Jancic. So watch for his Feet to Fire program coming back. I've been on that a couple times now for interviews, and so James Jancic is posting shows again. Keep up, check him out. He had to go off the air for a while because of economic reasons. But anyway, he called me up one day and he says, I'm driving in the Jupiter winds, and he was being tossed around the highway, and he said, I'm living the Jupiter winds, and I had to laugh. I said, yeah, see, I'm right about that. So at any rate, that was about a week ago. Just a quick note on UPS, United Parcel Service. Make it very specific who I'm talking about. UPS, you know, the brown trucks, in my estimation, are gouging, absolutely super gouging the public and companies on shipping. And so anyway, beware of UPS. If you can find any other means of shipping, don't use UPS. They're just gouging like crazy. The shipping costs are going through the ceiling. And this happens when industries or companies get greedy. They have had great success. They're using the oil shortage and fuel costs to jack up their prices to astronomical levels, and you see companies that do this eventually failing. But they got to get that grab up there before they you know, somebody in the upper levels is making a lot of money and they got greedy, and so all I can tell you is watch out for UPS. They're gouging like crazy. Okay, a guy named Russell Means, he was, I believe he was not full blood, but he was close to full blood Native American, died about a week ago, and I did not get this on last week's show. But there have been many articles reviewing his life and talking about the many things that he did. He was kind of a rough character. But he associated with some of the other people. David Banks was his name, one of the other Indian activists or Native Americans, and they did all kinds of sit-ins and protests and won a lot of rights for the Native Americans in this country, things that had been ignored, treaties that had been ignored for hundreds of years. He had a sit-in at Wounded Knee, brought attention to that event, some of the horrific events in the history of the indigenous people of this continent as they were just mowed over by the Europeans when they came in. But at any rate, Russell Means died about a week ago of cancer, refused to take standard cancer treatment, but finally died. I don't know, he had like a throat cancer or something like that. But at any rate, none of the articles, I read many articles on his life, etc., that were recently published, none of them talk about one of the major accomplishments of Russell Means, and that is that he started a bank within the Indian communities. And I'm saying Indian, I guess they don't like that term, because remember when Columbus discovered the Americas, he thought he was in India, so they called the natives Indians, kind of a misnomer that has carried through to modern life. But Native Americans, Russell Means started a banking system within the reservations around the United States. So they have an independent banking system, not dependent on the international banking. And boy, did they ever not want to mention that in any of the controlled news media articles on Russell Means. And they kind of made him look like a bad boy and somebody who was on the outs with his Native Americans. But at any rate, Russell Means did a tremendous amount for the Native Americans in a manner that was only possible. Okay, just a quick note on the election coming up. If you vote, all you're doing is promoting the idea that we live in a democracy. When we don't, it just keeps the facade going. And there have been a lot of lesser evil or greater evil type of issues raised in this election, and people are out there voting for one thing or to get rid of Obama. The end result is none of the politicians running today have a handle on what has to be done to cure this country, and that is to get rid of the bankers, the European banking system that is destroying this country. Enough said on that. Okay, the Koren again, just remember, go to the web page. There's a very limited amount of Koren, I would say under 30 boxes of this. So when it's gone, it's gone forever. And we had some left over. I didn't want to announce this until we were sure. But the first people there get it, and as soon as it's sold out, we'll pull it off the web page. Once again, it'll be $100 for 10 pounds of this amazing seed, and $150 for the 20-pound box. And when it's gone, it's gone. We will not be selling this next spring. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.